Hey there, it's Colt Cabana. Thank you so much for checking out the past shows from the archives. All the past ones in this feed are ad-free. I took out all the ads. If this is something you like, you can listen to every single episode of the Art of Wrestling podcast dating back to 2010, absolutely ad-free for only $4 a month on my Patreon. That's patreon.com/Colt Cabana. All right, enjoy the show.
This is the Art of Wrestling with professional wrestler Colt Cabana. It's Colt
Cabana. All right. Hey, guys. How you doing? Come on in. Let's do it. Let's listen to the Art of Wrestling, a professional wrestling podcast. It's also a life podcast. It's a personal journal. It's an entryway to the minds, the souls, the hearts, and the lives of the people involved in the world of professional wrestling. I am your host. My name is Colt Cabana. I am a person who has been known to eat mass quantities of watermelon. That's true. I'm a man who now has replaced jeans with the most comfortable sweatpants in the world, and I feel like I'm turning into some kind of Mick Foley here. But these Everlasts, they have not left me. They're so comfortable. I could wear them every single day. That's probably got to stop soon, but I am sticking with it for now. Most importantly, though, I am a professional wrestler. We are sitting here live in the studio apartment in Chicago, Illinois. Before we go any further, this is a fan-supported and listener-supported podcast supported by people just like you. We give it to you free of charge every single Thursday on ColtCabana.com, iTunes, wherever you get your podcasts from. A couple great ways that you can help support: rate, review, and subscribe on iTunes. Tell a friend via social media, via Snapchat, via LinkedIn. You know how you do it. Or if you got a couple, that was a joke, right? Okay. Or if you got a couple of bucks in your pocket, head on over to ColtMerch.com and DigitalColt.com. T-shirts, buttons, pictures, posters, DVDs, wrestling road diaries, Art of Wrestling comic posters. They're signed by both Cliff and I. Plus, there's some fun shirts over at ProWrestlingTees.com. Big guy shirts, black colored t-shirts. Great ways to support. ColtMerch.com and DigitalColt.com. What a crazy business that this is, professional wrestling business. And another thing that I think affects a lot of us, myself included, is rumors. The way people talk about people, spreading rumors, depiction of people's characters inside the ring, outside of the ring. And my guest this week, Shane Douglas, is a guy who I think there's a lot of different sways back and forth. I always think it's wild because a lot of promoters will always ask me about different wrestlers, who to bring in, who's difficult to work with, who's a nice person. Like, that's a big thing to a lot of people is like, not only will this guy make money, will this guy draw, but is this guy a good person? Will he fit into this locker room? And I guess that's about their character. Shane Douglas is a guy who I've known for many years now. I would even say dating back to the IWC days in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania with Norm Connors. I've known you since Norm Connors, if anyone remembers that one. Always been super nice, nothing but cordial and friendly, willing to share his knowledge. And sometimes you hear about he's going after this or going after that, and I've seen him get aggressive over that stuff, but that's what we all do, you know? For every comedy thing that maybe I can sink my teeth into, maybe he finds a promoter or a film thing or whatever, and we're just trying to get by, right? So in saying that, I've honestly never had anything but nice, positive interactions with my guest this week, and it was a real, real fun talk, and to me, always comes off as a real good dude, which is kind of fun because he's taken part of some of the most controversial wrestling rumblings in the past 25 years now, 1990. Let's see. We start with the NWA title dropping, and then there was all that Ric Flair talk, and then there was just I think he was part of like the first talking shit on the internet type of thing going around, but in my general being around, always been super nice and seems like a real, real normal guy. So either putting on a great act, but I mean, if you're crazy, you're not putting on an act. You're just a dude who's talking, and he comes off as one, and he's always has. So I think you'll enjoy it. A lot of stuff we weirdly don't get into. Sadly, I don't know, because the conversation just goes where it goes. But like Dean Douglas talk, sorry to break it to you. I guess in a perfect world, I'd really, really like to. I'd like to have an hour's worth of Dean Douglas talk and just talk all about it, because that was my, right in the heart of my childhood, I guess, 95, I was 15, and maybe I was just getting smart to the background of what was going on, you know, through a Torch subscription that I had. But we talk teaching, we talk NWA, we talk being young, we talk getting into wrestling, we talk older wrestlers, And I really enjoyed it. Shane Douglas on the show. A good one. For me, busy weekend. I've really been traveling a lot. I went down to OVW in Louisville, Kentucky on last Wednesday. And I tagged with Cliff Compton. And we sadly, didn't get to have a lot of time. It will be on OVW TV if you're living down there in the Louisville area. And you see me on your local television. I'm a TV star now again. Look at me. Haven't dropped that accent for a little bit of a long time here. Last time I was there, Ring of Honor was there. And, I was kind of on the skid, so it wasn't like the greatest feeling. And then before that, 2007, when I basically lived in that building. So a lot of memories came back, some good, some bad. Good to see some old friends. Good to see some new talent out there. And OVW is an enigma, almost. OVW is an enigma. Because it's like you don't want to get stuck in one place for 10 years in one specific spot because you're just going to not move forward. But if I'm a young wrestler and I'm getting into wrestling, that's a place that I want to be immersed into the wrestling industry. And it's there. It's green screens, it's TVs, it's promos, it's knowledge, years of knowledge floating around that place. So cool to see a home where people can go and just immerse themselves in the wrestling industry. That's OVW in Louisville, Kentucky. From there, drove home to Chicago, got on a plane, flew to FWE, Family Wrestling Entertainment. Some of you guys saw it, a free iPay-per-view on YouTube, which wouldn't make it an iPay-per-view now, would it? And then we did have a regular iPay-per-view. I mean, you want to talk about stacked cards. You want to talk about amazing locker rooms. Just going into that locker room, thinking of the people that were there. Trent with a question mark just showed up to hang out. Robbie E., Eric Young, Kazarian, Daniels, Carlito, Maria, Tommy Dreamer always hanging out. Joel Gertner was hanging out. Little Guido was wrestling. I mean, just a packed lineup. Sanjay, Sabin, you name it, they were there. If you don't know about FWE in the heart of Brooklyn, you should check them out. Always real fun shows, including like a sick ladder match involving the Young Bucks. And I'm not the only one stressing how good these guys are. I think you guys all know the Young Bucks are just the best. So fun to watch them here. They're tearing it up in Japan, but fun to be able to see them in America when they're in America. Then got right on a plane, went to Vancouver, hung out. Chuck Taylor and I, we got to just hang out with Scotty Mack and Lindsey Hart and some friends over there, and watched a comedy show called The Sunday Service. Taking in local theater, doing it, living life. That was a live your life situation. Vancouver Podfest was canceled for us, but I still got on the plane, still lived life, took in the situation, took in Vancouver. Now I'm home, podcasting, going to Remix next week. Then it's off to Japan for a couple of weeks. We're doing good. Traveling, touring. That's what we do as pro wrestlers. I love it. All right, the song of the week this week is from one of the best bands out there doing wrestling music. They're in touch with me personally. I love that. Rancid That. Please go on the internet, check them out, support them. This one's called Portrait of a True American Hero. Bruiser Brody off there. We Hate You all the way from Texas album. Enjoy it. We'll be back with the franchise, Shane Douglas.
From the state of Texas, standing 6'5", 280, a stock, a crush, a bruiser raw, a bruiser brody, real, take your hands and a fall. Bruiser brody, you were the man. Bruiser brody, a port of Rigo to your band. Bruiser brody, you were the star. No more. Standing tall with Stan Hansen, the two men from Texas, they terrorize Japan. Throw a chair in the crowd, making them all run for their lives. They shot everybody who came in fast, and they never done fell. When they're standing there, they gave him the name of Guadalajara. Intelligent monsters, the only man big enough and fat enough to dominate the technical wrestler, his head, and he put that big hairy poop right into the head of those Japanese punks. Bruiser Brody, you were the man. Bruiser Brody, from Puerto Rico to Japan. Bruiser Brody, you were the star.
You know what you're doing with the microphone, right?
A little bit, yeah. Sometimes I get shy, so you might have to draw it out of me.
Do you ever get shy?
I get not in the business. I get shy more in if I have to get my toast at a wedding or something, because I think people sitting there expecting to hear Shane Douglas do something, and mm-hmm. I'm thinking it's from Troy Martin's perspective. And so Troy Martin is so different from Shane Douglas that it's hard for me, in that kind of situation. I'm sure you know what I'm talking about, mm-hmm. like Cole Cabana to your real personality. You know, the fans expect to see what they see on TV in that character. And, sometimes, you hear from somebody saying, you're a lot smarter than I thought you'd be. Or, I can't believe you use words like that. I'm like, well, what is it? Because I'm a wrestler, I'm a Neanderthal, my knuckles drag on the ground. And, so that's about the time.
What would a situation be obviously you can't think of all of them, but there had to have been one situation where someone was like, whoa, where did that come from? Does anything come to mind?
Yeah. When I was teaching, I'd meet parents.
Okay.
The parents would come in and you'd start to talk and you'd start throwing phrases around. You're like, well,
Hold on. But they knew you were a wrestler.
Yes.
But you're also a teacher.
Right.
And they're like, how did you get so smart? It's like, I'm a teacher. Right. Right.
Well, and it was almost, everybody has the conspiratorialist point of view. If you're a teacher, then you must have known somebody or somebody pulled strings for you. Couldn't possibly be that, you're really an intelligent guy.
If you're a wrestler, you're saying.
Yeah, if you're a wrestler. Okay. Right. Or an athlete, pro football player, right. Pro basketball player. We're all supposed to be stupid, I guess. And the one that I always had, quandary within my brain is when people would they'd read your dossier or something on Wikipedia or whatever it might be, and they'd say, this can't be real. You were accepted to medical school in 95, I can show you the certificates and everything else. I worked my ass off for it. And you can see the disconnect to them. Like, this guy has cut the fucking music and, making fun of this and breaking people's necks. And you were going to medical school. I can actually do the ABCs all the way through without stopping. And I can add 2 + 2, 3 + 4 + 4 is when I start getting a little bit off. And I start having a little bit of trouble.
Now, you've been in wrestling. How long have you been in wrestling?
Years.
X amount of years.
A long time.
And you've seen a lot of guys rise to stardom who are, dare I say, kind of like maybe dummies. Is that true or no?
Well, I wouldn't say that. I think, the wrestling business had always been predicated, and I think the promoters did it by design, that they would look for the uneducated guys. Because if you come in and you have a master's degree, then it's harder to pull the wool over your eyes. And you know how many times a promoter has told you, well, we'll pay you this, and we'll do this and do that, and then it comes up and it's something different, And so the wrestling business, I think, had always been predicated. I don't know if it was by design or just sort of happened that way. But around the time that I was coming up in the business is when that started changing. Brian Pillman was an educated guy. Steve Austin had some education. Johnny Ace was well-educated. Mick Foley had been to school.
So I guess my point is, do you credit a lot of your success in wrestling to being a smart dude?
None whatsoever.
No, okay.
It's simply pure luck, because when I look back at it, I sit and I watch in the business today, and I'm sure at the same, all of us in the business do this, and you'll see guys and you think, man, that guy's fantastic. Why didn't he ever make it? And, I think, talent obviously is a big part of the equation, but also just the damn luck of the draw. Dumb luck. Right place, right time,
Can you, do you remember, I know that I hate on-the-spot questions, yeah. But do you remember any, guys, maybe around you, just great right place, right time situations?
Yeah, me and Mick Foley.
You and Mick?
When we were we were doing independence, this would have been around 84, 85, in that time frame somewhere. And Bill Watts at the time was trying to take the then UWF, the possessor of Mid-South, phenomenal wrestling company, just really good heels with heat, faces that could get over, had really good shine, great promos, just great angles. It was just a fun company to watch from my perspective. That's the kind of wrestling that I really, really was drawn to. And he came up, he was trying to compete nationally with Vince, which in hindsight was just a stupid thing to do. Vince was a juggernaut at the time. And
making corny music videos,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, exactly. And I, from my perspective, I thought this would be a great national product for those of us that love wrestling. And he
long story made short, Dominic and his generation had been screwed by Junior, Vince Jr. Vince Sr. had always told Dominic and Bruno and all those guys of that generation, stay loyal to me and you'll have a job for life. So when you retire from the ring, segue into agenting or whatever.
And there was, there's a couple guys, the Briscoes, Gorilla Monsoon.
Blackjack Lanza.
Right.
George Steele.
But a handful weren't, huh?
A lot of the guys got cut out. When Sr. sold it to Junior, Vince McMahon, the Vince McMahon that we all know, basically told him like that your agreement was with my father, not with me, and you're out. So these guys were in their mid to late 50s, and maybe some cases in their 60s, and looking that next phase of their career, and suddenly they have no retirement. In Dominic DiNucci's case, he went and worked for about 20-25 years at a Irish Mike McGee, I believe it was, or Davey O'Hannon, one of those two, got him a job at the New York Post delivering newspapers in the morning. And he would travel. He would stay in a small apartment up there Monday through Friday. Then Saturdays, he would drive home to be with his wife. So it was still like he was on the road. Hmm. And that's what a lot of those guys had to do, which I think was just a really shitty thing from Junior.
Did you feel, I know we're jumping off of how you got the right place, right time, but was there like a sad place in your heart when you saw this guy, Dominic DiNucci, had done it for so many years, and all of a sudden now, hey, what do I do in my career?
Let's face it, he and those of his generation have more than paid their dues. They didn't know what the inside of a plane looked like. You know, everything was in a car. Mm. They'd wrestle each town, the same town weekly, and they would make the circuit and drive around and heal up cars. And, these guys really paid their dues and put their time in. And in that phase, let's face it, in your mid to late 50s, early 60s.
And still looking for your next phase of your career,
right,
at 55 or 60?
Yeah. And, being that close to retirement and thinking you have this job set for life, that you're going to leave the ring and become an agent or whatever, and suddenly you're having to drive to New York and deliver papers 5 days a week, and just a really crappy thing to do. I don't know the whole story other than what I've been told from like Bruno and Dominic and Baron Cicluna and guys like that I had known. And I just thought it was just a really shitty thing to do to guys at that phase of their career, because let's face it, that's not something at 55 or 60 you say, hey, I'm going to put my resume out and get a job. These are something that guys had never done.
Did you wonder where all like their money of 40 years of wrestling had gone?
I knew that Dominic still had the first buck he ever made. You know, those guys were, people today would say tight. They were just smart with their money, because they knew just because you make $100 or $1,000 this week doesn't mean you will next week or the week after. And that generation especially was very, very careful with their money. You know, so I knew Dominic had the money that he needed, but he still needed health benefits for him and his wife and his daughter. And, he really, in Dominic's case, he's pushing 80 now. He'll kill me for saying that. He's pushing 80 and still in phenomenal shape. It wouldn't surprise me for him to make 100 easier or better. And, to have that kind of length of a retirement, you better have a pretty good nest egg put away.
Did you live like that?
I did. It's funny because we were having this conversation earlier today. You've done the same thing, Colt. It's, you reach that point in your career where you've starved through most of your career. For me, like the first 6-7 years of my career. And the road is a tough, tough place. Everybody, I love when people come to me and say, man, you have the greatest job in the world. You travel and you get to do. And there is a certain nice side to that that gets old after about 6 weeks. And living out of hotels and out of a bag and planes and rental cars gets old. To me, when I signed my first contract, I was never frivolous with money. I never went out there, I'm going to stay at a 5-star hotel because I can. But when it came, if I wanted to eat a steak dinner tonight, I would eat a steak dinner. I wasn't worried about at least taking the edge off the road from that point of view.
And where does that, because I'm always interested, where your mind says, because you knew those guys before. Like, what part of your mind says, okay, it's okay for me? Is it because you had, like, a nice, like, 3-year contract or whatever?
Yeah, well, it was the contract. But also, mine was having been bolstered by having 2 master's equivalencies and later accepted a medical school and having been a teacher. And, so I knew I had other things to fall back on. So I wasn't so concerned that with the wrestling, but if it dried up today, that, my God, how would I pay next month's bills?
Like Dominic DiNucci, the other guys. Okay, right place, right time. Mid-South. Bill Watts, he's changing it up.
Yeah, and he contacts Dominic and says that he wanted to use Dominic as the promoter in what we call the tri-state area, Pittsburgh, or, Western Pennsylvania, Eastern Ohio, West Virginia. And Dominic, that's the area that Dominic had promoted us with us. Looking back at the difference in the business, Dominic would have shows like, say, in Clarksburg, West Virginia. and the main event would be him versus Ken Jugan. And Dominik at that point had been off the air, off television, you know, as a star for probably 10 years or better. Jugan was always a mid to low card guy. But the rest of it would be us kids that didn't know what the hell we were doing other than just full of piss and vinegar.
And his Dominik students? Would,
yeah. He'd always open the match up with me versus Mick Foley because we had great chemistry. And then, you know, he'd have matches of all the other students that he had. At one point, about 20, 22 students. And when Bill Watts had sent a crew up to work, and Dominik had booked, I think, 7 or 8 days worth of shows through that area, through Ohio, Pennsylvania, West Virginia. And he sent Missy Hyatt and Eddie Gilbert, Dark Journey, Missing Link, Buddy Roberts, Chris Adams, Terry Taylor. Who else was there? I think Bill Irwin was there. Not a bad crew of guys.
Great crew, yeah.
Yeah, great crew of guys.
For like an indie show, kind of?
Yeah, so he had his students to work like the underneath and put with these guys. And Terry Taylor, at the time, Bill Watts was so busy with trying to grow the UWF that even though he was technically the booker, really Eddie Gilbert was doing the booking, and Terry was sort of his assistant. And so they would see me and Mick Foley go out nightly and have these really good matches. And in Clarksburg, West Virginia, Terry Taylor and Eddie Gilbert pulled me and Mick out the back of the armory and said, had you guys ever thought of, you know, going on the road full time? And to be honest with you, neither of us ever had. Not that we didn't love the idea of possibly being a wrestler, but, you know, at that point, when you're a young, snot-nosed kid coming into the business, you never think you have the talent to, like, be one of those guys. Mm-hmm. And so when they asked us, we were like pigs and shit, like, holy smokes, you know, they're asking us to go on the road.
When those guys all came up, was there like a little bit of like in your head, like, man, I hope they like me. I hope they think I'm good.
I'm sure Mick was thinking the same way I was. We were more nervous that they were there to watch, you know, that
to be like, these guys suck.
And, yeah. If we suck it up or whatever. And, you know, in hindsight, I mean, I don't think it's coincidence that Mick Foley and Shane Douglas became big names. We worked very hard and, you know, there's a lot of students did in the business, but that's the point that always intrigues me is what's the difference of the guy that gets that break and the guy that doesn't, and the guy, you know, they both have talent, all things being equal, you know, do you attribute it to blind luck, right place, right time, whatever right.
If there's two other students that went to that school, that trained, that were doing the openers and got seen instead of you and Mick, you're saying, right?
Yeah. And like in my case, the way it happened, like for me and Mick, about 3 weeks after that tour was over, Eddie Gilbert called me and gave me my starting date. But in the interim time, like within the 2 week period, they were going to call Mick and have Mick come in. He was supposed to be like right behind me. Bill Watts had gotten into financial straits with trying to grow the company too quickly and put on a hiring freeze. So I had gotten my foot, I just slid in under that deadline into the UWF, which is where I really cut my teeth in the business. Both in learning the road and learning to work and learning all the aspects of the business with working with stars. And as you know, it's just a very different beast of being a student in a school. And Mick ended up having to take the route through Memphis and, you know, do that whole deal and really paid a lot more dues, I would say, than I did in coming into the business.
Who were the guys that took you, like, I guess not, but who are you working on those undercards, at UWF at least?
When I first went to the UWF, Eddie Gilbert... he obviously saw something in me that I didn't see. And the first night in, I started working with him, a program with him. And then Terry Taylor turned heel shortly after that with Hyatt International. And the night that I won the UWF TV title, I had been in the UWF for weeks, maybe. And we went to Thibodaux, Louisiana. And I really do believe that it was just one of those things that happened, again, right place, right time. Sting was going to the ring and was supposed to get hit from behind by Terry Taylor with a chair and then come back out into the Spirit of 76 routine. But Terry hit him too hard and busted him open, hard weighed him. And he needed a bunch of stitches. So Tommy Gilbert came into the back, who was Eddie's dad, was the agent, looked around the dressing room and went, Shane, get out of the ring. And it was literally like, I don't believe it was by design or by plan. And I figured I would go to the ring and work with Eddie and put Eddie over. And, you know, at the finish of the match, when Eddie pulls me on top of him for the 1-2-3, I was more stunned than anybody in the building, you know.
But he liked you, Eddie did.
Yeah.
That original, when he saw you at those shows.
Yeah, he obviously saw something that, like I said, I didn't see. I honestly believe that I would wrestle. At the time that I went to Dallas to be with the UWF, it was based in Dallas-Fort Worth at the time. My fervent belief was that I would go down. My school loans were coming due. I had $77,000 in school loans that were coming due about 2 months before the deadline was, you know, you have a grace period. And I had no idea how I was going to even begin to pay that kind of money back. And at the time in 86, the economy was down and pretty sour, 85, 86. And when Eddie called for the job, my thought was I'll go down and do this for 6 or 8 months until the economy picks back up. And then I'll go to Washington or Harrisburg and pick up with my education, which was social sciences and government and public policy.
Yeah, I'm intrigued what kind of person, because I know, not to separate this between educated and not educated people, but like I know if I was saying that this was me, and I tried it a couple times because I went to college and I finished my degree.
Yeah.
And I remember like, and this is completely different, but just to kind of tie it in. I remember like there was a tour of China and I was like, Mom, I got to go to this tour of China. She's like, no way. You're staying in college. Yeah. When you're done with college, you could do whatever you want.
Right.
And so like I had to stay in college. But
smart mom.
Yeah. I mean, I guess, you know, I'm still a little mad at her. Well, I'm bringing up, you know, 15 years later on a podcast.
Right.
But you obviously had this plan of education. I don't know what kind of family or childhood. I guess I want to assume normal, but I don't know.
Well, actually, I wouldn't say like dysfunctional in the sense that we were like the Hatfields and McCoys or anything, but you know, my family was rife with divorce, and my mother and father had both been divorced multiple times, and my brother was divorced, my sister was divorced, my friend's parents were divorced. I was the first person in my family to go to college. So there was a premium in my head put on that, the sacrifices my family had made to allow me and afford me, even though I had to take out a ton of school loans. You know, my mother bent over backwards to help me through college, and my family and brothers and sisters, you know, everybody pitched in every way they could.
Did you feel that going to college was to like prove them wrong, or
no,
to be like
to thank them? I remember very well going to college. Because it was such an unknown quantity to me. I had nobody to tell me this is what freshman year is going to be like. This is what that's going to be like. So I thought, even though I wasn't a bad student in high school, I wasn't I wasn't the guy that went home, the bookworm that went home every night and studied. I did enough to get by. I was a B student, occasional A, but was able to sort of coast through just based on, you know, being able to just put in a minimum amount of effort. And when I went to college, I thought this is going to be a completely different beast. I was intimidated by college because I had no idea what to look forward to. And when I got there, luckily for me, Cody Michaels, whose real name is Mark Keenan, was my freshman year roommate.
Get out of here.
And, yeah. And we, you know, watching him, Mark was a very good student. And so I picked up an awful lot watching him and his study skills, and learned a lot from him. Mark's a very intelligent guy. His brother's, he's a chiropractor now. His brother's a surgeon, a trauma surgeon. So just in watching him, I mean, that helped make the segue into college a lot easier. But I was always afraid that, like, one fuck up and I'm out of here. You know, one screw up, one bad test, one bad this one. So I put a lot of pressure on myself freshman year.
But you know, so many of those guys freshman year fuck up everything and still finish.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
6 years seniors, they're all finishing still.
Yeah, I had the sophomore slump. Mine was because freshman year I did fairly well in freshman year. I was like an A- student, and not that the classes were easy, but I think it was more that I came in just ready to.
To
swing for the fence, you know, and thought, well, that was easy enough to get an A-. And then sophomore year came and the classes were much more difficult.
I felt freshman year was, and like, I didn't even do as good as I should have because they were super easy. You know, like they were just super easy. And then, it starts getting
harder.
They
suck you in.
Yeah. So when did you start wrestling? And then when did you start splitting out of college?
Well, I started wrestling. The way I met Dominic DiNucci was when I was in eighth grade, my friends and I had seen in one of the pro, we were huge wrestling fans, just grew up in Pittsburgh, you know, Bruno Sammartino, every Saturday night. That's what we were talking about Monday morning at the bus stop and all week long.
Bruno was just
The man in Pittsburgh.
The man, huh?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, today, I could go down to Permane Brothers in downtown, you know, in the Strip District, and Bruno's been retired for, what, 35, 40 years. Hey, franchise, how you doing? The very first question out of their mouth after that is, how's the legend doing? How's Bruno
like
doing?
Equivalent of, like, Michael Jordan to Chicago kids?
I would say so, yeah.
Yeah.
From that generation.
Right,
yeah,
right.
My generation. But when we were in eighth grade, we saw this picture of a kid in the magazine, Pro Wrestling Illustrated, that got his picture in the magazine. He built this really pathetic-looking ring with carpets, and like the ropes had, like vines or something hanging off of them. We were all pretty handy. And my brother had just come home from the Navy, so he had these rolls of Nogai, which is imitation leather. And we went to the junkyard and stole this great big, like, 40-foot, which turned out to be stainless steel. It was probably worth hundreds of dollars.
And, but they had this ring that was shit.
Yeah.
But you didn't have a ring.
Yeah, we didn't have a ring.
So it was, like,
it was on.
Legendary.
Yeah,
we, yeah. You know, like, that, like, oh, my God, how did those guys have a ring?
Yeah.
You know,
it looked and, like, got their picture in a magazine.
Right, exactly.
For it,
exactly. You know?
So we went and we decided that we were going to start. My friend Bill Peterson, his dad owned a bar called the Fifth Street Cafe. We would go down on Sundays to watch football. I remember watching the Eagles play the Raiders in the Super Bowl that year.
This is eighth grade?
I was in eighth grade. Okay. And, you know, we'd clean the bar up and you know, we'd take a little sip of beer and thought we were cool because mm-hmm. we were drinking beer and everything, you know, and just, and we would take his, he had a Super 8 camera. We would videotape or film ourselves with Super 8 film with no sound. And, you know, you go back, I'm sure he still has these films and you see, like, we, you know, hitting each other with boards and we'd go down behind the pool table and come with ketchup on our face or, you know, just having a goofball time as eighth graders. And when we built this ring, then we screwed around in it for a couple weeks and that became boring. We thought, now what are we going to do with it? So at the time when I was a kid, muscular dystrophy for the Labor Day telethon, they used to do these things called backyard carnivals. You know, put on some games or whatever in the backyard, raise $5-$10 and send it into Jerry's kids. So we thought, let's do a backyard carnival with a wrestling show. And
I'm going to stop you right here.
Yeah.
Was there a picture of you in a backyard ring in PWI magazine?
Yeah, there sure was.
Was
yeah.
it from what you're about to talk about?
Yes.
Wait, I totally remember this.
Yeah, yeah.
As like a high schooler.
Yeah, and what's strange, Colt, is if in that picture, in the front row of that picture, is the girl I would marry years later. It's the mother of my kids. So it's just one of those really strange, like inbred, you know, New Brighton, small town Pennsylvania things.
Well, so you guys build the ring. That was on like before they were stars, PWI. Is that what that was?
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. Before yeah. Wow. Stars, yep. I just remembered that as you're saying.
You got a
this.
Good memory. Yeah. Yeah. It was,
well, it's the same way as you when you're a kid, you know, not a kid, but sure. when you're like ready to get into wrestling, yeah, like and everything's awesome. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. Well, we went over. There was a woman by the name of Angeline Paparella who has since years ago passed away. She was a nurse that had adult onset muscular dystrophy. And this woman was. Looking back, you know, being mature now and looking back, as opposed to being an eighth grade kid and not paying attention to that kind of stuff. This woman was an amazingly courageous woman. She could only move a few fingers. She was, her head, everything was immobilized by muscular dystrophy. And the woman put in a Herculean effort to beat muscular dystrophy. It was stunning to, in hindsight, looking back from today and thinking about it, how hard this woman worked. And we went over this idea, and I'm sure she thought, you know, seventh, eighth grade kids building a ring, yeah, sure, you know. Well, she called me up about a week later, and she said, there's a local wrestler that said if he's in town, he can come by and maybe make an appearance. It's an Italian name. Well, of course, we said Bruno Sammartino, and she said, no, it's not Bruno. And the only other wrestler that I knew who lived in the area that I was from was Bill Berger, who was a job guy at the time. Mm,
definitely Bill, not Italian.
Yeah, Bill was a good
Sounds
guy.
Sounds Jewish.
Yeah. So he... She said Italian name. So she started hemming around. When it's Denarini, Donanucci. It's Dominic Denucci, who at the time he was the world tag team champion with Dino Bravo.
Wow!
So as kids in eighth grade that watch wrestling every week, and you're telling me the world tag team champion might be coming by, we were like on cloud nine.
Yeah.
And his wife called us a few days before and told us that she was pretty sure Dominic was going to be in town. And we had ended up selling probably about $100, maybe $80-$100 in tickets. We went around to all the local businesses and got like gifts to get, like to raffle off and stuff. And we ended up having a pretty good little show. So entertaining. What we did back then, and it's funny that where the business has gone, because we didn't do it like we would do it in the old school where we just get in the ring and lock. We didn't know how to do that. We would literally script the match out, and then we would practice it over and over.
You didn't know any better. You were 15,
yeah,
right?
We were right. And So I remember Dominic pulling up in this big white LTD and getting out of the car. And as a young kid in eighth grade, seeing this, it looked massive getting out of the car. I just remember thinking that chest and shoulders just getting out of that car. And he came over and he watched and he stayed up, off to the back, watching the matches. And me and my partner had wrestled in the main event. Me and a kid named Joe Grieco, I wrestled
a literal kid. Yeah, by the way,
yeah, not exactly. And but we had, looking back, knowing I know the business now, the matches must have been entertaining to watch, especially to a pro watching kids goof around. And Dominic came down and got involved in the. We had a heat, hot finish, and he came down and they cheated. And he's pointed out and got involved. And afterwards, we took pictures out front of the bar, and my brother-in-law was taking the pictures. And I remember Dominic asking us how old we were, and I said, "Well, we're 14. How old are you?" And he said something like, smart ass, can you never ask a wrestler how old they are?
Oh, sorry, I did it in the beginning of this. Go on.
And he said something about, I think at the time he told us he was 48. And I'm guessing, as we know the business today, he was probably lying about his age then, probably 50, 51, or, right at that age. But even if he were 48, if you do the math, that puts him around 83, 84 now. And he's... just you pull into his house. My youngest son went to school right around the corner from his house, and we'd stop periodically, and he'd pull in. There's Dominic dragging a tree across the field, or chopping wood, or doing whatever. Dominic was just a really, really fantastic influence in my life at that time, because not only did he teach me the business, but he did it for free. I didn't have a pot to piss, and my family was as poor as could be.
Right. In college, student loans.
And years later, when I signed my first contract, Dominic never brought money up, but he gave me the key to my job was to be at the school early, turn the heat on, turn the lights on, sweep the ring out, get the ring ready, that kind of thing. So he gave me chores to do. But I still felt that, like, everybody else had paid. I think it was $1,500, and he never charged me. So years later, when I signed my first contract as a dynamic dude, I went to his house and took him out for a drink, and I slid this envelope to him, with $2,500 in it. And that was my way of saying things, because I could have never afforded to pay that. And I was very, very appreciative of him doing that. He got pissed off at me. He saw what it was, and he slammed that money back at me, and... you'd have thought like I was trying to ask his daughter out for a date or something. He was really hot about it. And that's just the kind of guy Dominic was, and is. I can, at those key points in my career, and I'm sure you're the same way, at the key points in your career where you meet the right person to train you, and then from there, then Eddie Gilbert takes a shine to you, and then from there, you go and then you work with Arn Anderson, and then Steamboat becomes your partner, you become his partner, then turn heel and you get to work with Terry Funk. At very critical points in my career, had I not gotten those breaks, you really can do the what if I hadn't, would I become the heel that I was able to become in ECW, or would I became the mid-card guy that became the main eventer with Ricky Steamboat, or would I have not learned the business if I hadn't been with these people at the right time? So
what did Dominic exactly, like, what was the anger from when you gave him? I get the idea where he'd be like, no, what are you doing? Stop. But
yeah, he was angry because to him, we never talked about it, but I'm guessing that to him, he felt like I had opened the school up and he gave me jobs to do and I did those. And
you'd paid enough.
I had that in his head, that was my payment.
Right.
And to me, I would have done that anyway. And I wasn't doing it to try to be rude. It was my way of saying thank you very, very much. And it just, shows you what a gentleman he is. Mm-hmm. It's like, hey, take your money and shove it up your ass. I don't want that. I think Dominic is very proud of the fact that he's trained Shane Douglas and Mick Foley and Cody Michaels and several others that have, had a good impact on independent wrestling. I think, as now from having been in the business for 15 years, if you get a chance to have that kind of an impact and leave somebody behind you that's having an impact on the business, I think especially that generation of wrestler, that was, I think the real reward to a good career.
Right, especially better than a check for $2,500.
Right, whatever. Sure.
You said your first contract was the Dynamic Dudes, which is WCW, and Johnny Ace.
Yeah.
Weren't you like in the Royal Rumble and stuff?
Yeah.
WWF?
Yeah. Well, that was, I was in the Royal Rumble, I think it was 92. My contract with Bill, with Johnny was in 88 or 89.
Oh, that was after? Oh, I'm sorry. Okay.
Yeah, and I'd been in the business, but back then they, you know, they were more than content to pay you on a nightly and without any kind of leverage ever. When I, little known fact, when I was Ricky Steamboat's partner wrestling with the Hollywood Blondes, Brian Pillman and Steve Austin, all three of those were under contract. Steamboat, I think, was making $386 a year. Austin was making $215. Pillman was just a short bit behind that. I was making $300 a night, and was fearful of going in and saying, "Hey guys, you know, I'm pitching in here too." But Bill Watts, to his credit, at that time there was a lot of upheaval in the.
Is that when Bill Watts was with the NWA then, when he was booking?
Yes. He was booking the NWA.
Did he bring you in?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, he gave me the opportunity to come in and put me with Steamboat very quickly, and unfortunately the company, that's when the company started having like this these erratic ups and downs, and Bill, 1 week Bill was in tight, the next week he was on the skids, and there was this whole, is he going to be here, isn't he? But he asked me, he said, as a favor to him, and he said, would you please wrestle the first quarter at the nightly that we brought you in at, and I promise you at the beginning of the next quarter, we'll get you a contract. Well, in the next quarter came, things had gone even worse. So he asked me to do a second quarter, which I did. And then when the third quarter came, that was supposed to be the first quarter of this contract, he was fired on a real quick in and out. Bill Watts was fired and Ole Anderson was brought in. And Ole had the nerve to tell me that he didn't know what I was complaining about at $300 a night.
Of course.
Because that was what he made at my age.
That's some real old-time shit right there, man.
Yeah. And I it was like, you know, like I'm in the bizarro world. Mm-hmm. You know, I've got a guy that's 55, 60 years old that was wrestling in 1963 telling me that he made $300 then and I should be happy that in 1993
right.
I'm making $300
a night. Should be grateful. Should be kissing his ass, actually. Fuck. Why were there ups and downs?
Well, I think at that time it was more, you know, Dusty would hotshot book for a while and then they'd push him out. And then they had the committee thing, you know.
Was there up and downs of money coming into the company, though, business-wise?
I think business-wise.
Or just weird political ups and downs?
Yeah, political up and downs.
Okay.
Because, you know, the company, if you think about it, it was owned by Time Warner or Ted Turner at the time. I forget who it was at the time. But, you know, they were putting programming on three networks, TBS, TNT, and I forget what the third one was. Then they were having pay-per-views. So they had more than ample money coming in from advertising and everything else. And wrestling is historically a much cheaper 1 hour program to put on than, say, a drama or a, you know, murder or cop drama, whatever. But the political wise, you know, this guy would come in and backstab the current booker and get rid of him. And then 3 months down the road, somebody would come in and backstab him. And there was this constant, you know, first it was Jim Herd, then Jim Herd almost bankrupted the company. They got rid of him. Then they brought the committee in.
Was Kip Fry in there somewhere?
Yeah, Kip Fry was in there somewhere, was just handed big checks out to everybody. The committee came in and consisted of Kevin Sullivan and Jim Ross, Jim Cornette, Ric Flair, and I think there were a few others. But each of those guys, of course, you know, Kevin Sullivan was worried about the Varsity Club, and Jim Cornette was worried about the Midnight Express, and Flair was worried about who he's working with, and all of them could give a damn about the other things. And so the committee just sort of fragmented, and it was really like a rudderless ship for a long time.
And you were just a young kid, so like
happy to be there.
Right. Yeah. Paycheck. Yeah, for sure. When do you feel your career, like you went from a non happy to be there guy to a like, I'm ready to start rocking?
It was when, towards the tail end of Johnny and I being together, I had been off, I had hurt my knee working with Midnight Express in Bluefield, West Virginia, had to be off for like 2 or 3 weeks. And the whole time I was off, Jim Ross especially was calling me at home several times a week and was burying Flair and, or not Flair, Luger and Sting and those guys. All these guys know what the fuck they're doing, and they're pains in the ass, they're prima donnas, on and on and on, and telling me that when they brought me back, they wanted to split me and Johnny up and give me a singles push. And I didn't talk to Johnny about it because there was so much upheaval at that time, you never knew what was true and what wasn't. So I thought, well, we'll wait till I get back and see. And the first TV I was back, Johnny Ace wasn't even there. So that led me to believe that there was some truth to it. It was in Baton Rouge, Louisiana. I sat down at catering for lunch, and the production meeting had been going on for the previous couple hours. Missy Hyatt, who had a knack of getting things incorrect once in a while, she came out of the booking meeting. She goes, Shane, how did you get so much heat? They were talking shit on you in there. And I thought, well, what do you mean you're talking? I just got back. I mean, how could I possibly have heat? I just literally got back.
She got it so wrong. Sorry, go on.
I went walking down the hall to see who I could find. That first person I saw was Teddy Long was walking down the hall, and Teddy Long was managing Mark Callis at the time. He said, Shane, you're going to be working with Mark today. 3 minutes heart punch, he'll take it on you. And I said, well, I have no problem putting him over, but he'll not beat me in 3 minutes with a heart punch and just job me out. So I went looking for Jim Ross. And Jim Ross goes, no, goddamn, Teddy's got it wrong, and you know, used some very colorful language. And he said, go find Jody Hamilton. Jody Hamilton has the right finish. So I went looking for Jody Hamilton, and when I got over to the far side of the Baton Rouge Centroplex, Jody Hamilton was sitting at, you know, one of the lighted mirrors, makeup mirrors, and was writing stuff. And I walked in, he wouldn't even look at me. He had his like right shoulder turned to me, and he's going, and I said, well, you know, Teddy Long told me this, and then Jim Ross told me it was wrong. And he wouldn't even look at me, but he said, if you like your job and value your job, you'll do the fucking job in 3 minutes and keep your fucking mouth shut. And that was like where the straw snapped. I was like, fuck, I will. You know, I knew enough about the business at that point that, you know, going out and doing that, A, wouldn't elevate Mark, because I'd been off for three, four weeks and really hadn't been established as a single. And, you know, Jim Ross is telling me all this stuff. So I was going to get to the bottom of where exactly was this lie starting. So I went to get my stuff to leave, and Johnny Ace and Brian Pillman and Tom Zank stopped me, tried to, and tell me, you know, stick around and, you know, do it through the political channels. And I just had it at that point. I was so tired of the lying and all the upheaval and, you know, finger pointing, you know, everybody doing, you know, the scarecrow routine this way.
And again, is it like, again, in the back of your head, I've got this degree, so like if I say fuck off and they say fuck off, well, at least I know.
I can go back and teach. I can go back to school. I can, you know, go back to Harrisburg, D.C., whatever. But I never wielded that like a weapon. It wasn't like, do this or else, I'm leaving. You know, it wasn't like that. Because I did by that time have a real affinity for the business. And
you got to stand up for yourself.
Yeah, I wanted to know, where was the heat starting? Where, you know, what was the eminence of the heat? And so I went to leave, and I called Eddie Gilbert, somebody that I knew I could trust. And Eddie said, what I suggest you do is, instead of flying from Baton Rouge to Pittsburgh, fly through Atlanta and meet with Jim Herd in the morning, because what he was telling me was that they would have one meeting in Atlanta and tell Jim Herd and the office personnel, we're going to push this guy, and this guy. Then they'd get out to the field and they would do something completely different, and then go back to the office and say, well, Shane Douglas refused to do this and this part. So there was just all this kind of like quandary going on, and this, you know, this, you know, just this undercurrent of undermining everybody. And so I went to meet with Jim Herd, and it was the most bizarre, or certainly one of the most bizarre meetings I ever had in wrestling. I went down the next morning at 9 o'clock in the morning, and he told me he knew what I was doing there, and he knew that I'd been talking with WWF. I had talked to Pat Patterson through Dominic, but not even about work. It was just sort of, hey, how you doing? Nice to talk to you, that kind of thing. You know, it wasn't like, hey, can I come in and get a job there? And
where do you get that pizza at?
Yeah. And Jim Herd had heard about that, and he said he knew what I was about to do, and I was making a huge mistake. And he reached into his desk drawer, and he's leafing through papers, and he pulls a piece of paper out, and he goes to hand it. He goes, I have the ratings here to prove it. Now, at the time, Vince was crushing WCW in the ratings, you know, like 4-1. And he goes to hand me the papers. I reached for it, and he pulled it away. Like a, haha, gotcha, you know. And he said, now, I'm just going to let you know that being that you're a wrestler, you're probably not going to be able to understand this. And that was where, like, my head about exploded on my shoulders, and I grabbed it. I said, I don't fucking understand anything you got on this goddamn desk. And I read it, and it was amazing. He was taking the WWF rating, which was like a 7.8 or 8 point, something, you know, in that range. And then down below that, they had Memphis, Portland, Louisiana, Florida. They had like 7 or 8 listed. Like this one had like a 1.3 and this one had a 0.7 and all added up. They were still getting beat. It was still like 7.8 to 6.9 or something. And he said, so you can see there, you know, we're on the climb and we're challenging. And you know,
so he didn't even understand.
He had no clue.
And he thought you were coming in to barter this deal. You're going to WWE. You just want to know why you didn't, you were losing in 3 minutes.
Yeah. You know, look, I'll put anybody over. I mean, for God's sakes, I'm the guy that put and suggested Bula McGillicuddy pin me, you know, so
right.
It's not that I, you know, Shane Douglas wanted to do a job, but it makes no sense for me to do a job that doesn't A, draw money for the company, B, help the person that's beating me, C, help me. So when there's no winner, to me, that's a losing situation for everybody in the company, especially. And when I left his office, I thought, this is the best move I could make in my entire career to get the hell out of here in 1990. It was 89, late 89, early 90, because it was clear that this guy was a moron and had no idea. He might have been brilliant when it came to corporate America.
Right, or a nice guy. I don't know.
Well, he wasn't even so much a nice guy. But, you know, when it comes to professional wrestling is unlike really any other industry that I've ever been aware of. And this guy clearly was in way above his head, being eaten by the sharks from below and the water dousing him over the head from above.
It's such a different animal, isn't it?
Yeah, it's unbelievable. Yeah. And there was, I mean, this guy was a hugely successful corporate America guy.
They all are, Shane.
Yeah.
They all are.
He was just getting alive by wrestling. And that was my first break to go to WWE.
Oh, so then you peaced out.
Beast out, went up, and Pat Patterson was clear. I left Jim Herd's office and called Pat Patterson from the lobby of the CNN Center, and he said, "Shane, I can't promise you anything. There's no openings right now, but you come up and work hard, and I promise you we'll give you an opportunity." I was treated fairly well that first time up. You know, I was no big star. I was a mid-card guy, but they always put me in good positions and gave me good talent to work with. And at the end of that year and a half, when my dad came down with emphysema, Vince and I had part of the most cordial conversation he and I ever had. And it was basically, family comes first. You've been a great talent for us. The door's always open. And that's when I left to go take care of my father and started teaching school.
That's when you started teaching school.
Right, 91.
Wow, okay. I mean, we are kind of winding down here, though. But I do want to know, I think a lot of people in my generation, I remember you from everything just because I'm a big fanboy, you know, but, you know, ECW, like, and just the idea of you getting on the mic and you controlling the mic and you just being a master out there. Does that, like, I feel confident on the mic now. I feel like I'm pretty good.
Yeah.
As a kid, I wasn't some crazy outgoing, you know, right, always, right. You know, it's just
so
like,
was I.
Right. Yeah. For me, it's just kind of like wrestling kind of like taught you how to do it. And eventually you got to a spot where like, oh, like, I guess I'm pretty good at the mic.
Yeah. And have fun with it.
Is it?
To me, it was, I think, much more basal than that. Where I grew up, I mean, to me, like when you play Cowboys and Indians at 6 years old, you know, I would point my gun at you and bang, and you'd grab your chest and, oh, drop down. And, you know, you were, to me, it's the same thing in a promo. All you have to really have command of is the facts, the fact of the angle you're in, who you're working with. And when you get good enough at it and you understand how the process works, you can even steer the angle a little bit. Like, if you want to go a little bit over here, okay, we'll just throw this seat in and this seat, and then it sort of takes the storyline that way. But where I grew up, very average, run-of-the-mill, you know, lower-middle-class neighborhood. Every kid could talk shit. Every kid could do a promo in eighth grade. You know, it just like what you did on the ring. You know, hey, you know, you know, blah 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 blah. You piece of shit. And somebody fires something back, and it was just one of those things. And to me, I'm fairly certain that one of the huge influences on me in my promos was having grown up being a huge fan of wrestling and watching the superstar Billy Grahams and, you know, the Bruno Sammartinos and the Valiants and all these guys do these promos from all sorts of different, you know, one was, in Bruno's case, he was the hard-nosed Italian immigrant. Then you had George the Animal Steel, and then you had Fred Blassie, and you had Albano, and you had all these different references.
Different characters.
Yeah. And for me, it was always easy. Like, I always tell young kids when they'll ask me to watch their matches and stuff today, and I'm sure the same as me, we're all the same in this business in this sense. Every one of us gets lost at points in the match. I mean, it just happens. You get hit in the head. You're thinking one thing. You see that pretty girl in the front row, whatever, and your brain goes blank for a second. But when that would happen to me, I could literally, in my head, because I have a photographic memory. That's what made me a good student. I could see lists in my head, you know, the page in my head. For me, when I got lost in the match like that, which happened quite frequently, I'd think to myself, what would Bruno do in this spot? You know, what would
WWBD?
Yeah. And, you know, and at least help you muddle through that point so you didn't look like a clusterfuck with your thumb up your ass. Either you're, okay, I'll pick the guy up and slam, I'll do move, whatever. But at least got you to that point where your brain got back on track. And I think that's part of what's wrong in the business today with these young kids that are, I always liken it to my generation was more athletic than Bruno's. These kids are exponentially more athletic than my generation was. The difference is I was brought into the business at a time when it was demanded of me to learn step one to get to step two. And if you didn't learn it the first time, you might get a rare second opportunity. But it was rare a third one came. If you couldn't get it by that second time, you were out, and they'll go to Colt Cabana and try him. And if he doesn't get it, they'll go to the next guy. So there was this always constant pressure to learn and learn and ask questions and pay attention and watch the matches. And
what I love about your generation is you guys were all kind of molded by those older guys who like did those crazy territories. And then when it was Monday Night Wars or whatever, ECW, just that awesome era of wrestling.
Yeah,
like it was a totally different game. Yeah. And you guys all felt like these new exciting characters, but innovative you were, but you were all Memphis and USWA and like that's where everyone, not everyone, but a lot of you guys cut your teeth, and it's kind of cool, right?
You had to, you know, and it was, you know, every one of us has a favorite in this business, you know, and I've got multiple favorites. I had a very interesting conversation weeks, maybe months into the business. Dominic took all of his students up to Montreal. Dino Bravo and Rick Martel were running a TV territory up there at the time, and Bill Irwin and Scott Irwin were there doing the Wild Hogs thing, and
they later did a movie, I feel.
yeah. Not a bad one.
Really? Not a bad one?
Yeah.
You're going to say that in Wild Hogs is good?
I can say when Scott Irwin lost all that weight and changed his name to John Travolta, that was...
Yeah, okay. Robin Williams. Okay.
But I asked Scott, I said, well, how'd you guys come up with this gimmick? You know, the biker thing and the high top boots and this, and, you know, the long coats. And this is who we are. And he told me flat out, he said, kid, don't even try to think of being original. Everything's been done. We've had cowboys and Indians. We've had Frankenstein's monster and mummies. And he went through this whole list of things. He said, pay attention to the wrestlers that you like, the styles that you like, and try to adapt your character and the skills that you have to those. So like for mine, like for the franchise character, there's obviously a huge amount of flair in there. I was a huge flair mark. There's also a lot of Ricky Steamboat, but then there's subtleties from Barry Windham, Brad Armstrong, and a handful of other guys, the Andersons and Tully. There's little like speckles of stuff that I'd see and take from those characters because I was huge fans of those guys. And you know, throw it all together and stir it in with a big amount of your personality thrown into it. I think that's what makes a good character. I've said it a million times. None of us are great actors. And you know, if you want to see, just watch a Hogan movie, watch Pro Wrestlers versus Zombies. None of us is gonna win an Academy Award.
He is in a movie, and he's telling you he's not a great actor.
We had a great time. What makes the movie entertaining is it's us being self-deprecating, us making fun of ourselves.
It is what it is.
Yeah. It wasn't Citizen Kane, and it wasn't Gone with the Wind. It was Pro Wrestlers versus Zombies.
Right.
But the reason I think it works on the level of what it is that to see a Rowdy Roddy Piper, you know, a larger-than-life personality from the huge days of wrestling, and Jim Duggan, and a Shane Douglas, and Matt Hardy, us playing off each other, making fun, and, you know, not making fun of ourselves, like, ha-ha, you look like an idiot, you know, just playing off those characters and just the little things, the little interactions and things that, you know, I think to a wrestling fan, like when you see Piper pick up a coconut, Johnny Q. Citizen sitting down and watching that movie would, okay, so use the coconut. Where'd the coconut come from? But to us wrestling fans, sure, that's an iconic point, yeah, of professional wrestling. And so it works at that level, but none of us are great actors, at least in my experience. I say that speaking of me. So when you look, I mean, I thought Roddy was very good in They Live and things, but if you ask Shane Douglas to go out and portray a Gold Dust character, I'm not so sure I could pull that kind of a character off. It's too far of a stretch. Dustin was phenomenal at it. But you know, it's, to me, it keep it much closer to the real personality, and then accentuate that and throw some, you know, steroids on it or whatever, no pun intended, you know, that character then becomes larger than life, right, and takes on its own personality.
Very cool, man. Wow. I mean, there's so much that we can go into. There's so much cool stuff. Are you promoting anything? The movie
Pro Wrestlers versus Zombies. Trauma Distributors are a North American distributor. We've had the movie out, our version of the movie, which is minus 11 minutes of what Trauma has. Trauma's is a much more, I wouldn't say much more adult oriented, but their footage is the kind of stuff that guys like us would really enjoy watching, if you get my drift. They're getting ready to distribute theirs. They had shown at the Cannes Film Festival, which every time I say, I can't say it without giggling, because to see Pro Wrestlers versus Zombies at the Cannes Film Festival to me is a bit of a joke, but they're behind it. They're solidly behind it. They have something going to the Comic-Con in San Diego coming up. So, and they have a huge following, which I've only come to learn after signing with the movie with them. I think Pro Wrestlers versus Zombies, for what it is for wrestling fans, could become, you know, sort of one of those cult movies, like,
sure,
Attack of the Killer Tomatoes, or, you know, the Toxic Avenger.
I would even say, remember Body Slam?
Yeah.
You know, like, that, I feel that's kind of culty.
Yeah. See, to me, I go back even before that, like with Sly Stallone doing the, what was it called, Tin Pan Alley. He played a wrestler.
I don't think it was Tin Pan Alley. It was something Alley.
I
know what you're talking about.
There was a movie that he came out wearing sausages.
Yeah. I know there's a thing where he did a wrestler, yeah.
But, you know, those kind of movies that really just catch on to that audience, and for fans like us that grew up watching wrestling would be involved and love it. And so they're getting ready to distribute that here very soon. Great. We're currently writing the sequel to it, a sequel, prequel, whichever it's going to be, and lining up talent for that, and just laudable things. Yeah, hey, I've told you, I told you in the first place that, you know, and Cody has, you know, my biggest thing to Cody Knotts was, when he came to me, was it wasn't so much for me to call my friends and get my friends involved in the movie, but it was, I didn't want to put, because I knew a lot of the people that had put a lot of money into this movie, I didn't want them to get there and suddenly have, you know, Shane Douglas, the prima donna, sitting on the set, and, you know, well, wait, I need blue M&Ms in my dressing room, that kind of shit. It would just turn them off, you know, to wrestling. And
so you had to pick the right, make sure the right guys
were right mix of guys. Yeah. And I think we accomplished that, but he wants to use a new slate of guys for the sequel.
To one of the guys at WrestleCon, actually, and they came up to me and asked me about it. Yeah, so
it's a lot of fun.
Hopefully I'll see you on the set.
It'd be a lot of fun, yeah.
Are you on, like, Twitter or Facebook or anything?
I do the Facebook thing. It's really strange. My publicist, Bridget Petrella, passed away unexpectedly at 51 years old.
Gosh.
And she was the one that set my Twitter or my Facebook account up. I had resisted, you know, at my age, computers were not something I came up with, you know, in like a organic fashion. And not that I'm afraid of computer. I mean, obviously now I use them quite extensively. But at the time, I just wasn't, I didn't really think that Shane Douglas was so important that, you know, it would warrant me stopping at a computer and saying, I'm taking my dog for a walk now, or whatever, like anybody would give a damn. But she was one that pushed hard for that and got it up and running.
Yeah, they are important. I mean, it is, you know.
To the fans and the audience you're reaching.
Not, hey, I'm eating breakfast, but hey, you can see me in Pittsburgh.
Right, absolutely,
hey,
sure. And when she passed away last January 2nd, the account numbers and usernames and passwords that I've been using for 2.5 years suddenly didn't work. So I don't know if she, just by coincidence, changed them before she passed away. But because the account was in her name, I've had a hell of a time trying to get them to switch it over to something and realizing this is really me. And
that was her last rib on the way out.
Yeah, last rib. She got a good one. But,
fucking
you. So we're and I'm working on getting a Twitter account. There's a Twitter account out there that somebody told me is under the official franchise Shane Douglas. It's not me. But it's I'm going to go and contact. Am I right? And if I contact them and prove that I'm Shane Douglas, I can take that.
Yeah, but it's hard to contact them. But
is it right?
All right, we'll try to get you on. I'll see what I'll see if I can help you out.
Beautiful. Still work on the on my autobiography. It's one of those things. Not that it's taken this long to write. It's just every story as I was writing through the first 13 chapters sort of digressed into, and this was my friend Chris Candido, and he was a great partner. We had all this, and then he died. And then this was my brother Bam Bam Bigelow, and da-da-da-da, and then he died. And it just seemed like every chapter was sort of devolving into that, and I just took a break from it. But I'm going to go back through it now that I've had a couple years away from it to go back and re-edit those chapters. Because I don't want, as much bad as I've seen in the business, I feel like I've been immensely blessed in having the career that I've had and being able to do the things that I've done and see the things that I've seen, good and bad. Because I grew up watching my mother work 10-hour days till her fingers bled for $2.35 an hour, and my dad half kill himself on the railroad. So I want the book to sort of reflect my appreciation and the wonderment that I have of the business. And the hope that I have that the business gets back to something that we recall as being professional wrestling.
Yeah, that's great, man. I can't wait to read it. Thanks for being on.
Hey, appreciate it, man. I appreciate it, Cole.
Thank you.
Thanks, buddy.
All right, there is the franchise. Like I said, I think there could have been so much more, but that's where it went. And I enjoyed it. I enjoyed talking about Danucci. That's Dominic Danucci to me and you. That's the nickname we gave him. The Nooch. Not even Danucci. The Nooch. Talking about the Nooch. Shane Douglas always got his hand in something. I think I got to get in the Zombies Wrestlers too. It's my new goal. Not going to make it to Hollywood, but I'm going to make it to this goddamn Zombies movie. All right. Before we get out of here, let's get in some plugs and
upcoming events.
All right, the best way that you can support, coldmerch.com and digitalcult.com, Twitter and Instagram at coldcabana, my very public email if you need something, coldwrestling@gmail.com. Marty DeRosa and I are over at worstpromoever.com. Go on over to my website, coldcabana.com. I got a P.O. box there. I love getting snail mail. Facebook.com/AOW podcast. Like it. Upcoming Saturday, October 11th, I'm in Marietta, Ohio. RemixProWrestling.com. October 18th through November 8th, I'm part of the Global League all over Japan for Pro Wrestling NOAH. November 15th, I'm in New Orleans, Louisiana, doing comedy. HellYesFest.com. Two shows Saturday night. Saturday, November 22nd, Rahway, New Jersey. Always one of the best shows on the East Coast. ProWrestlingSyndicate.com. And Saturday, November 29th, Winston-Salem, North Carolina. WrestleK.com. That is the show for this week. Big thank you to you for listening at home. Thanks to Shane Douglas for coming on the show. Thanks to Cable Guy Jeff and Stu Stone, Kid Russell, and Matt Jenkins on the music. Let's thank our sponsors, HuluPlus.com/Colt. We'll get you 2 free weeks of this amazing fall lineup that's about to happen at $7.99 a month. It's basically the best way to binge watch all your favorite shows anywhere, anytime. They're a great supporter. I highly urge you to at least do the 2-week trial if you're even thinking about it over at HuluPlus.com/Colt. Thanks to HighSpots.com, hundreds of full-length titles available to download, plus all the $5 wrestling titles, AMA knee pads, wrestling gear, wrestling ring, a canvas if you need it. Thanks to ProWrestlingTees.com and BarbershopWindow.com, the original alternative and independent wrestling shirt companies, both powered by 1HourTees.com, custom t-shirts made to your liking in an hour or a week or whenever you need them. And TweakedAudio.com/Colt, the earbuds that I use, get over 30% off and free shipping just because you listen to this show that now is over. That's right, this has been the Art of Wrestling. For Colt Cabana, I'm Colt Cabana. Thanks.
Fucking music! My name is the Fred! Magi Shane Douglas, and you're listening to The Art of Wrestling, a show that's not afraid to fucking shoot just the way it is. I remember a time when I was with the WWF, and I was supposed to shoot on Shawn Michaels, but the pussy didn't like what I had to say, so Brooklyn Brawler came to me and he said, hey, Shane, can you change this and say that? And I said, fuck you, Brawler, and fuck the boy toy. Fuck Scott Hall, fuck puke piece of shit Hogan, fuck Razor Ramon, and fuck the whole goddamn clique. The franchise is the number one guy in all of pro wrestling, and I'm talking about the sport of professional wrestling, not this fucking puke piece of shit sports entertainment that Vince McMahon wants you to believe. I gotta go. I'm gonna go fuck Francine in the back. Now hit my fucking music!